Today is Wednesday, October 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, the latest from Essex, as a truck was found earlier today with 39 dead bodies.
Early indications suggest that one of these people was a teenager. The rest are believed to be adults.
Also ahead, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson gets a win and a loss. But what does that mean for Brexit? And U.S. President Donald Trump announces what he called a permanent ceasefire in Syria. Those stories and more are all coming up next on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump announced what he called a major breakthrough for achieving a better future for Syria and the Middle East.
Early this morning, the government of Turkey informed my administration that they would be stopping combat and their offensive in Syria and making the ceasefire permanent, and it will indeed be permanent. However, you would also define the word permanent in that part of the world as somewhat questionable. We all understand that, but I do believe it will be permanent.
Trump also said that he would remove all sanctions that Washington put in place in response to Turkey's military operation, although he did reserve the option of reimposing them at a later time if something he's unhappy with occurs. Iraq's defense minister also said Wednesday that U.S. troops withdrawing from northeastern Syria to Iraq are transiting and will leave the country within 4 weeks. Russian military police also began patrols on part of the Syrian border Wednesday, quickly moving to implement an accord with Turkey that divides control of northeastern Syria. Jamil Jaffer is the founder and CEO of the National Security Institute at George Mason University near Washington. He spoke to International Edition's Lori London about the arrangement between Turkey and Russia.
It's obviously a big deal that there's a deal now in Syria with the Turks and the Russians. But obviously, this is a direct result of the U.S. not playing a central role in this effort. We were the ones who went in there, who worked with the Kurds to defeat ISIS. They actually did all the work. We provided them support. And now Russia has the upper hand. They're the ones running the operation there. They're the ones negotiating with Turkey. They're the ones helping our allies, or at least protecting them now from being murdered by the Turks. I mean, it is a ridiculous situation, complete collapse of U.S. leadership in the region. Leadership, by the way, that we have lost thousands or hundreds of lives in order to obtain, and that we hand over to Russia at our own peril. And by the way, let's not forget that the Russians are aligned with the Syrians, who are aligned with the Iranians. So now you have an agreement between essentially Iran, Syria, Russia, and Turkey, none of which cuts in the U.S.'s favor.
What does that mean as far as U.S. national security?
It's nothing good. It's empowered Russia to be a much bigger player in the Middle East. It's empowered Iran because they're client state Syria has now solidified its hold on power. ISIS is empowered by the Kurds having to pull back, and it is highly unlikely that the Turks or the Russians are going to do nearly as good a job as our allies in protecting the territory from ISIS. And frankly, the Russians don't have our best interests at heart. And so the fact that we've given them the initiative here is a mistake for U.S. national security, and in the long run will be bad for U.S. policy in the region.
That was Jamil Jaffer, CEO of the National Security Institute, speaking to our own Lori London. Now, to gauge the reaction of Kurds in the U.S., VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Nuzad Brafki, director of the Kurdish Community of America, or KCA. It's a Texas-based organization that provides resources to Kurdish Americans and Kurdish refugees in the U.S. and educates the public about both groups. Brafki, whose family came to America as Kurdish refugees from Iraq, noted that this has been a busy and painful time.
Yes, we have been contacted through our organization saying, please help us out, advocate for us. We don't know where to go. We don't know what to do. Many civilians have been killed. Many children have been killed.
Give me the example of a Kurdish refugee here in the U.S. who's called you.
He's in Minnesota. His name is Jamal. He contacted us and said, my family's been affected. I talked to him the other day. The signal was really bad. They were crying, and they were saying they didn't know what to do, where to go. And the phone was cut off, and he hasn't been able to talk to him for the last couple of days, and he's very worried.
What did you tell him?
I told him our resources are limited. We've contacted legislators to advocate for the Kurds, that Kurds play a strategic role, that civilians are being affected, killed, and providing education through social media and trying to let people be aware of what's really going on, that this isn't a fight between Turkey and the Kurdish fighters, but this is affecting the civilian population. This is causing more refugees in the area and devastation.
And before, you mentioned another Syrian Kurdish refugee here in the U.S. who's been in touch with you.
Yes, so another gentleman, he's fairly new to the United States, just came from San Diego, California to Minneapolis area. He called our organization, was just begging for us to do something, and we're unable to go into Syria. Volunteers can't go there because of the Turkish bombing. So when things get settled down and there's enough financial support, hopefully we can send some volunteers to be able to help the refugee situation and provide winter supplies. Winter is coming up. We did that in 2014 when ISIS came into Iraq and created chaos and thousands of refugees to flee their home. A lot of refugees, they went to the Kurdistan region of Iraq for a safe zone and were able to provide families with winter supplies and basic necessities for every day. It's really shocking to see what has happened.
So what's to be done? What are the prospects for some relief?
We need action, and I don't think Donald Trump will do anything about this. President Trump has talked about we don't want to have refugees here. We don't want to be involved in endless wars. Well, guess what? He just made more refugees. He just made more wars happen. This is just a very sad situation. The United States has always helped the oppressed and has always been there. It's up to Congress right now to step in, and it's up to the European countries to step in and create a no-fly zone. And I think that's the best option for the refugees at this moment.
So you're saying it's not really about politics, it's about aid.
Yes. For us here, we know what we see in the news. We see politics being played. But if people really care about humanity, if people really care about peace, we need to think about how we can help out, whether it's financial donations, calling their federal legislators or politicians and encouraging them to continue to support the Kurdish cause and continue to have this no-fly zone be in effect, because civilians are dying. All we hear is Middle East is war, war, war. But there was an area in northern Syria, the Kurdish part, which democracy was being played. People were free. ISIS was under control, and we as human beings need to step up and end brutal campaigns by Turkey or any other country. We need to have our voice be heard.
That was Nuzhat Braki, director of the Kurdish Community of America, COA's Adam Phillips. In addition, new findings from two University of Maryland critical issue polls conducted between September 3rd and 20th and October 4th and 10th revealed that the debate over U.S. withdrawal from Syria and the, quote, endless wars of the Middle East today splits American policymakers and the public, transecting party lines. Professor Shibley Telhami is a non-resident senior fellow at Brookings and the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. He analyzed the latest data on American public opinion on an array of issues pertaining to U.S. involvement in the region, including the U.S. withdrawal from Syria, the escalation with Iran, and the U.S.-Taliban peace process. He spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi, starting with U.S. opinion on the withdrawal from Syria.
From day one, when we started testing that, on the day the president announced his withdrawal, we found that the immediate reaction is that only less than a quarter of Americans supported the withdrawal decision. And as time went by, with the criticism coming from members of Congress, including Republicans, fewer people supported the operation. Nonetheless, throughout the poll, which preceded the vote in Congress opposing the move, we found that less than half opposed the withdrawal from Syria. So while, in fact, the support was even smaller, less than a quarter, it shows that the opposition to it wasn't quite as strong as one might have expected, given that the American political elites, both Democrats and Republicans, almost unanimously condemned it.
Do the American public opinion support a U.S. role in reaching a settlement for the Arab-Israeli conflict?
But what we do find is that an increasing polarization between Democrats and Republicans on the question of support for Israeli policies, both in terms of Israeli occupation and in terms of Israeli settlements. So we have found that Democrats tend to be more critical and Republicans tend to be less critical. And that has expanded to include issues that we have not tested in the past.
How did the United States public opinion react towards the U.S. escalation with Iran, especially after the attack on the Saudi oil facilities?
On Iran, we had an amazing opportunity where we were already in the middle of a poll when the Saudi oil fields were attacked. We had a large sample of 3,000, almost split down the middle, 1,500 before and roughly 1,500 after. And so we're able to test it. And so what we found is that the public became more critical of the administration policy toward Iran after the attack. We found that the public became more fearful of war with Iran after the attack. But we found absolutely no impact on the overwhelming opposition to the war, with three-quarters of Americans saying, we don't want a military option exercised in this case.
What did your survey indicate vis-a-vis the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan?
You know, the Afghanistan question was really interesting because the public is far more divided on Afghanistan than we expected. There are a good number of people, roughly a quarter to a third, who think that we should keep some troops in Afghanistan. We have a lot of people who believe that the U.S. has responsibility to allies in Afghanistan after the pullout, so it should be exercised. Nobody supports increasing troops in Afghanistan. People are divided, essentially, between those who want to maintain current levels and people who want to cut and people who want to withdraw troops altogether.
How about the talks with Taliban?
Americans are really divided on the talks with the Taliban. You know, they're almost down the middle between supporting and opposing. And that seems to apply to both Democrats and Republicans. But even among Republicans, there's more opposition to talking to the Taliban than among Democrats, which is surprising given the fact that you have a Republican president who's doing the talking.
That was Professor Shibley Telhami, non-resident senior fellow at Brookings and the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. He was speaking with my VOA colleague, Mohammed El-Shenawi. And you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
A weight loss plan called the ketogenic or keto diet has become quite popular over the past couple of years. The keto diet restricts the amount of carbohydrates consumed to no more than around 50 grams a day, which reduces the amount of glucose or sugar in the bloodstream. While the keto diet has been credited with not only weight loss, it also helps diabetics manage their disease. A new study from scientists at the University of Texas at Dallas suggests that restricting blood glucose levels might also keep certain cancers in check. Experimenting on mice with lung cancer, researchers fed them a keto diet and a diabetes drug that prevents glucose in the blood from becoming reabsorbed by the kidneys. The researchers say they found that while this regimen didn't shrink tumors, it did keep them from progressing. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Police in southeastern England said 39 people were found dead Wednesday inside a truck container. Deputy Chief Constable for Essex Police, Pippa Mills, said police were in the process of trying to identify the victims.
Shortly before 1:40 a.m. today, we received reports that a number of people had been found inside a lorry's container. We believe the lorry is from Bulgaria. Emergency services attended, but sadly all 39 people inside the container had died. Early indications suggest that one of these people was a teenager. The rest are believed to be adults.
The 25-year-old man from Northern Ireland who was driving the truck has been arrested on suspicion of murder. He remains in custody. Mills said it was expected that this will be a lengthy investigation. The Bulgarian embassy in London says it will work with the British authorities, and Prime Minister Boris Johnson called the crime unimaginable tragedy and truly heartbreaking. Speaking of the prime minister, he was weighing Wednesday whether to push for an early election or trying again to pass his stalled European Union divorce deal. This comes after Parliament blocked a fast-track plan to approve his Brexit bill before the UK's scheduled departure from the bloc on October 31st. Lawmakers backed the substance of Johnson's divorce deal in principle late Tuesday, but rejected the government's plan for fast-tracking the legislation through Parliament in only a matter of days. I spoke with London-based reporter Henry Ridgewell to learn more. Henry, I wanted to ask you really quickly. The Parliament had to take two separate votes on measures regarding Boris Johnson's Brexit bill. Can you explain really why?
Yes, the first vote they had was on the deal in principle. So that deal that Boris Johnson brought back from Brussels, that vote initially was rejected last Saturday, you'll remember. Instead, Boris Johnson tried to introduce what's called the Withdrawal Agreement Bill, which would put that withdrawal agreement into British law. That was voted through by parliamentarians because, for the first time, because they want to make some progress with Brexit. What the lawmakers rejected was the timetable that Boris Johnson was trying to do that with. He was trying to fast-track that through Parliament in just 3 days, huge amounts of legislation that would normally take weeks to pass through Parliament. So they rejected the timetable, not the deal itself.
So where do things stand now? Because, you know, Brexit is basically a week and a half away.
It is, and everything's in limbo at the moment as Britain awaits a decision from the European Union on whether to grant an extension and of what length as well. That could take probably at least another 2 days as the EU Council President Donald Tusk contacts all the different capitals of the 27 other member states and asks them their opinion. It has to be a unanimous decision. And so while we wait for that, lawmakers here will plot their next move. Boris Johnson says that if the EU comes back with a three-month extension, which is the amount he was mandated to ask for by law this week, then he will push for an early election because he says he won't have lawmakers messing around trying to amend the bill, trying to delay Brexit further. His only problem is it's not within his power to call an election. Lawmakers have to essentially approve an election, and it's not guaranteed that opposition lawmakers will see this as the best opportunity to have an election. They might want to see Boris Johnson suffer a little bit more and humiliate himself a little bit more by asking for an extension. And so this delaying process could go on a little further. As it stands, Britain is still to leave the European Union on the 31st of October, but most expectations are that Europe will grant an extension of around 3 months.
And if there is a new election, what kind of impact would that have for Brexit?
There are differing scenarios that could play out. If there was an election, then I think you would see the European Union take that principle very carefully. If there was a new government that wasn't headed by Boris Johnson, then they would seek to negotiate a new Brexit deal, and then anything's on the table, really. It could be another referendum, it could be a new Brexit deal. We're just not sure what would happen then. If Boris Johnson was to have an election and to win, he would stick with his deal. Theoretically, he may have a bigger majority in Parliament. He doesn't have anyone at the moment. He could push this deal through quickly, and Brexit would happen.
Henry Ridgewell, reporting from London. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Good to be with you again, Steve.
Two business associates of President Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, are in New York court today in their campaign finance case connected to Ukraine. The AP's Julie Walker has that story.
Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman are scheduled to be arraigned on charges they conspired to make illegal contributions to political committees supporting President Trump and other Republicans. Prosecutors say the pair wanted to use the donations to lobby U.S. politicians to oust the country's ambassador to Ukraine. At the time, Giuliani was trying to get Ukrainian officials to investigate the son of Trump's potential Democratic challenger, Joe Biden. Trump's personal lawyer has said the president knew nothing about the donations. Parnas and Fruman are both free on bail. Julie Walker, New York.
Hong Kong's legislature on Wednesday formally killed the extradition bill that sparked 4 months of anti-government protests on the same day that the murder suspect at the center of this issue was released from jail in Hong Kong and said he plans to turn himself in to Taiwanese authorities. But protesters and opposition legislators say this is a small concession that will not lead them back down the road from all five demands they seek from Hong Kong's government. VOA's Anita Hill reports from Hong Kong.
The man in the middle of Hong Kong's political maelstrom said little upon his release from prison Wednesday, the same day that legislators formally rescinded the bill that mired the city in 4 months of anti-government protests. 20-year-old Chen Tongkai inadvertently set off 4 months of anti-government protests in his hometown, Hong Kong, when he violently killed his pregnant girlfriend in Taiwan last year. The semi-autonomous Chinese city cited his case in February in proposing legislation that would allow Hong Kongers like Chen to be extradited to China for trial. That lit a fire in this densely populated city, which since its handover from British rule back to China in 1997, was allowed by Beijing to operate under a one-country, two-systems agreement. This proposed extradition bill, many residents felt, was a step too far towards Beijing. And so the protests started in June, and violent clashes ensued between protesters and police. And the demands morphed into something much bigger than this piece of legislation. The city's chief executive, Carrie Lam, suspended the bill in June, but the demonstrations continued, with protesters in this leaderless movement shaping five demands to their government. Those include universal suffrage, an investigation of police violence during the protests, amnesties for protesters, and the full official withdrawal of the extradition bill. On Wednesday, they got one of those demands, when members of the city's legislative council officially withdrew the bill. But activist Lung Kwok Hung told VOA that it is not enough.
I think it's too little and too late. The five demands from the Hong Kong people should be dealt with. So Carrie Lam needs to tackle the rest of the demands, and she needs to deliver the leadership in order to make the whole community remember those things should not be done again. And she needs to deliver a roadmap and timetable to solve the problem of Hong Kong. I don't think the Hong Kong people will stop protesting just because of this late and little concession.
Immediately after the bill was formally withdrawn Wednesday afternoon, opposition lawmakers called on the city's security secretary to resign. He did not reply to their calls. Lawmaker Raymond Chan told VOA that he, too, would not ease up on his demands within the halls of the legislative body.
It is not important. We will still give pressure on Carrie Lam and the secretary of the government, force them to reply the five main demands of the society.
Chen, the murder suspect, has also inadvertently set off a turf war between Hong Kong and Taiwan. He indicated Wednesday that he would willingly surrender to Taipei, where he faces murder charges. But Taiwan's leadership has asked Hong Kong to try him. They have refused, arguing that Taiwanese authorities have jurisdiction. On Tuesday, Taiwan's president, Tsai Ing-wen, lamented the situation. The Hong Kong government refuses to exercise its jurisdiction, she says. This leads to its own fellow victimized citizen failing to receive justice. If this happened in another country and the Hong Kong government adopted this attitude, every country's government would feel bothered. On Wednesday, Chen emerged from prison in Hong Kong, where he served 19 months after being convicted for using his dead girlfriend's credit cards after her death. He looked meek and contrite. He stopped by the cameras, bowed deeply, and said softly, "To the society and to Hong Kongers, I can only say sorry." Meanwhile, protests are set to enter a 21st week. Anita Powell, VOA News, Hong Kong.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is establishing a high-level panel on internal displacement to focus on the millions of people who flee their homes to escape conflict and violence and remain in their own countries. He said the number of internally displaced people worldwide has continued to grow in recent years, with more than 41 million people uprooted by the end of 2018. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, engineer Rob McLean, and managing editor, Kay Pound Dawson, thank you very much for listening. You'll also be able to find in-depth coverage of world events and news on the VOA News website. And don't forget, with our VOA mobile app, you can download our stories and take them with you anytime, day or night. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.